Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I just want to encourage everybody to subscribe to the channel on YouTube or on whatever podcast feed you're on, and also to like this video or this podcast so other people find out about it. That's how we get the other people know. In fact, I was just looking at the stats for the YouTube channel, at least this morning, and a large amount of people who found out about the channel were just YouTube recommending it, which is a little bit ironic since we don't follow the narrative, but they recommend it. And that's because we've had a lot of subscriptions and likes in the past few months. So continue to do that. Tell your friends to do that. That'd be great. Okay, well, I'm excited about today's interview because we have somebody in the family, so to speak. So Timothy Flanders is here. He is the new editor-in-chief of our sister publication, 1 Peter 5. I'll explain what that means in a second if you don't know. He is a founder of The Meaning of Catholic and is the author of the book Introduction to the Holy Bible for Traditional Catholics. He has an upcoming book. I'm not 100% sure if I got the title right, but it's basically Uniting Conservative and Traditional Catholics. I'll stick to that, let you explain it more later. That will be coming out, I believe, next month. So welcome to the program, Timothy.
Thanks, Aris. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Yes. We've had some discussions, I know, in your Meaning a Catholic channel, which I enjoy greatly. So it's great to have you here on the Crisis Point podcast. I want to make sure everybody's clear who's listening or watching. So what happened was about a month and a half ago, I think it was, Crisis Publications, which is kind of the parent organization for Crisis Magazine, Crisis Publications acquired the website, online magazine, 1 Peter 5, which a lot of people might have heard of. It has been one of the leading traditional Catholic websites in the world, frankly, over the past five to eight years. And so we acquired it, and then Tim was made the editor-in-chief of 1 Peter 5 shortly afterwards. And so there's this relationship. That's why I said it's our sister publication. But I do think a lot of questions arise, and this is what we're going to talk about today, about the fact that Crisis Magazine traditionally has been a conservative Catholic magazine. Like, everybody would just agree, yeah, it's a conservative Catholic magazine. Has been since 1982 when it was first founded. 1 Peter 5, on the other hand, has been unapologetically traditional Catholic magazine. And so the question becomes, what's the relationship here? How can conservative Catholics and traditional Catholics work alongside each other? I think that's what we want to talk about today, is where is the overlap? Where is the division? I think first of all, I ask you, Tim, and I might give my own answer to this as well, but I want to ask you first. How would you define a conservative Catholic, and how would you define a traditional Catholic? Because obviously your definitions matter here. How would you define each of those terms?
Sure. I think that the general difference has to do with the Second Vatican Council and the new Mass, which is, in general, a traditional Catholic is rather critical of the Second Vatican Council, and does not believe that the crisis in the church is unrelated to it. The traditional Catholic wants to do something different, to say the least, with Vatican II than simply implement it more. The conservative Catholic follows their greatest sages are obviously John Paul II and Benedict XVI. So the viewpoint espoused by them regarding the council and its implementation would be followed by conservative Catholics. In other words, the Second Vatican Council must be implemented. Basically, the problem in the church is not the Second Vatican Council itself, but rather that the Second Vatican Council has not been implemented yet, or it's still being implemented. We still need to implement it to solve the crisis in the church, more or less. So that's sort of a conservative mentality and a traditional mentality. The traditionalist is also, perhaps even more than the Second Vatican Council, is critical of the new Mass, and believes that the new Mass is a valid rite. There's no both of them agree that the Second Vatican Council and the new Mass are valid in and of themselves, but there are differences as to the traditional would say, well, the new Mass has certain inherent problems with it into its texts and rubrics, not just the abuses. And then the conservative will say, well, the texts and rubrics are fine. The problem are the abuses, which is kind of the same thing they say about Vatican II. So that's kind of the general breakdown that would differentiate them. Notably, it's not primarily a difference of dogma and doctrine, which is what separates the conservative and traditionalist from the liberal heretics. The liberal heretics, obviously, they would actually, we would call them heretics because they are denying dogmas.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. And I think that, you know, I was a conservative Catholic. I consider myself more of a traditional Catholic now, but I'm very sympathetic to conservative Catholics. Obviously, Crisis Magazine, we print a lot of, we run a lot of articles by people who consider themselves conservative Catholics. We always appreciate those contributions. I think probably, like you said, in a nutshell, the conservative Catholic doesn't see Vatican II as the issue, but the spirit of Vatican II, so to speak, the bad implementation of Vatican II is the real culprit here that's caused a lot of problems. I think all of us would agree, like conservative Catholics and traditional Catholics, that there's a lot of factors that's caused the fall of the church in the world over the past 50 years. I mean, obviously, modernity, all these outside forces are, but internally, the conservative Catholic would say that the implementation got hijacked, essentially, from Vatican II, whereas the traditional Catholic would point more to the documents themselves, to Vatican II itself. I also think, wouldn't you agree, that the conservative Catholic is much more reticent to criticize popes directly. I mean, definitely not JP II and Benedict and Francis even. I think that's changed a little bit under the pontificate of Francis, but I still feel like there's more reticence on the part of a conservative Catholic. He's more naturally unwilling to publicly criticize the Pope directly, maybe say it's a translation problem, or maybe it's just he's Argentinian, so he doesn't see things differently, whatever. Whereas a traditional Catholic is much more likely to say, no, Francis himself is causing some of these problems that we have in the church today. Not that he's the sole cause, obviously goes way back before him. But I think that's generally, and I think you make a good point about the mass, the new mass, that I know as a conservative, when I was conservative, more of conservative Catholic, I was very much critical of abuses in the mass, but I didn't really see the new mass itself as having problems or issues. Whereas, like you said, the traditional Catholic, obviously the rallying cry of the traditional Catholics is the traditional Latin Mass. So I think, you know, that's a good way to put it. So now that we've kind of defined, and by the way, whenever we use these definitions, I always get somebody who criticizes us that says, oh, we shouldn't have labels. I'm just Catholic. Okay. That's nice in a vacuum. That's nice in a fairy tale world, but I think we just have to have these labels. They're necessary because of the situation we're in. And I think your three major categories, conservative Catholic, traditional Catholic, and kind of your liberal Catholic, but more accurately, as you said, liberal heretic, are probably the best three most general Catholic categories. I think people can fall into, you know, it's a spectrum. You know, some people might fall not as neatly as others. Okay, so now within traditional Catholicism, I want to talk for a minute about the kind of rallying cry of unite the clans, because 1 Peter 5 recently had an article about this where you talked about the editorial stance of 1 Peter 5's unite the clans. How do you see this phrase unite the clans? What do you think it means, and what does it mean in practice, at least for 1 Peter 5?
Sure. All credit to Michael Matt of The Remnant. He's the one who sort of began this movement 2018, I believe, or was it 2019? I don't recall, but a couple of years ago, which was essentially the divisions among the trads themselves, which are trying to resolve liturgical abuse and the deficiency of the new mass texts and rubrics by means of the Latin Mass and preserving the tradition. There's been some disagreements on difficulties about mainly the FSSP and the SSPX, which began in 1988. So this division between these two groups, which was essentially, do we go with Lefebvre or do we go with John Paul II? and there's sort of pluses and minuses or pros and cons and debates on both sides. And so there was a rather bitter division between these two groups. And then there was other groups that formed sort of with the FSSP under the Ecclesia Dei Commission. And Michael Matt came out saying that essentially the idea is that when you're on a battlefield and there's a foreign enemy invading your land, there are many different factions within the nation that may disagree about different things and different ways of doing the nation, but the foreign enemy is sort of a bigger problem that we need to face right now, even though we disagree and we may even hate each other in a way because we have bitter disagreements. The foreign enemy is coming against us, and we need to unite these clans, these different tribes with different viewpoints, to face an even greater enemy. So it's not, and it's the key point is that we're not saying that these disagreements are not important. We do want to resolve these things that are important, but we're recognizing a degree of importance that is greater in terms of the destruction of the liturgy, the iconoclasm that goes on, the sacrilege against our Lord and the Blessed Sacrament, the loss of souls in the church. And we really need to have enough charity to be able to distinguish between this thing that is far more important and far more pressing versus this less important problem, which is extremely complex, very multi-sided, takes a long time to resolve it. A lot of studies need to go into it. We just don't have time to work all of that out before we can unite against this imminent enemy who's bearing down on our souls. And so it's a question of urgency. It's a question of complexity. It's a question of importance. And Unite the Clans is saying, hey, I may disagree personally with something that Lefebvre did or said, but I recognize that Lefebvre, if I look at him charitably and sympathetically, we all need to interpret everybody in this whole controversy. We should look at John Paul II sympathetically. We should look at Lefebvre sympathetically and just say, hey, I think that they were trying their best. They may have had a wrong step here or there, wrong way of saying things, a wrong way of doing things that in hindsight we can recognize as wrong. But we recognize a common thread and a common effort for tradition, for orthodoxy, and that we can see as an imminent problem, an imminent disaster happening right now in our parishes to our children that we need to face right now, that we don't have time to work out some of these things before we face that together. So the idea is, hey, we're going to unite on the battlefield. I hate you. I hate your guts because I'm so mad at your position on this, but I recognize that we're going to be brothers on this battlefield against this foreign enemy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I think that's a good way of putting it, just to make sure everybody who's listening is clear on what the people involved is. That so Archbishop Lefebvre is the founder of the Society of St. Pius X, which I think most people have probably heard of, who would listen to this, and probably all of them have. And so in 1988, he consecrated bishops. I don't even want to get into the debate about the term used, illicitly, invalidly, all that stuff. You know, the point is that when he did that, John Paul II did declare that he and those bishops were excommunicated. Whether or not that excommunication was valid or not can be debated. That's part of the whole thing you said, the complex debate. But essentially, that's what happened. And so some of the members of the society then broke off and went to JP2, and they founded the Fraternity of St. Peter, FSSP. And so obviously, there's going to be a lot of bitterness, a lot of division between those two camps, because on a very important step, they split and they went in different directions. And so that even though that was 33 some years ago, it still exists today, some of that animosity between them. And so that's a good way to describe it. Now, my question then is, we're still going to stick within traditional Catholicism for right now, because we're going to get to uniting conservative and traditional Catholics, if that can be done, in a minute. But within traditional Catholicism, when you say unite the clans, are there any boundaries to that? Because obviously within the kind of umbrella term traditional Catholics, you have people who do not believe Francis is the Pope. you have people who do not believe that the new mass is valid, do not believe that Vatican II was a valid council. You have all these different, you know, that would be under this general umbrella of traditional Catholicism. What would you say would be, are there any boundaries? And if so, what are they?
Yeah. So I encourage any listeners or viewers would like to read this in more detail. Our editorial stance, if you just Google editorial stance, 1 Peter 5, that has all of this broken down. But there are basically three non-negotiables. One, we accept Pope Francis as the reigning pontiff. Two, Vatican II is the 21st Ecumenical Council of the Church. And three, the new mass and sacraments are valid. And the reason we don't have time to go into all the complexities of why those are non-negotiable, but suffice it to say, if you start to question certain of those things, depending on how you question them, if you're going to say that the validity of the new mass is in question, you're going to be questioning so much of the church that we're going to question ourselves outside of the church. We're going to question ourselves outside of the indefectibility of the church. And so at that point, we start to go off into areas that we really can't go into without making serious theological problems for ourselves. Shit. Suffice it to say, there's more to it than that, obviously, but those are the non-negotiables in terms of traditionalists. Now, the trad movement, if you want to go back to Una Voce back in the mid-1960s, Dietrich von Hildebrand, these different sort of godfathers of this movement have never really seriously questioned those things. And so sort of, if you want to call it the mainstream trad, are sort of all in agreement on some of these basic things. Right. And as soon as we get into questioning those, it's beyond the pale.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Because at that point, I think, would you agree that at that point, once you start questioning those three things, that, you know, who the Pope is, whether or not the council or the mass is even new mass is even valid. Now, like you said, you're questioning some fundamental aspects of the Catholic Church itself. And I think you call in the question its indefectibility and some other aspects of it. If we haven't had a Pope since the 1950s, that raises a lot of problems.
Yeah, I mean, you're entering into an apocalyptic scenario, basically.
Right.
You're saying that the church has been completely deprived of priests, almost completely. It's been completely deprived of sacramental grace. It's been just completely deprived. The basic indefectibility of the church is based on the fact that the church will always exist as this sacramental society, which dispenses the necessary graces for salvation. And so if you're going to question it at that level, you're questioning the very fundamental indefectibility of the church.
Right. Now, before we go, I just thought something else before we go into the conservative and traditional Catholics together. Traditional Catholics have a reputation for a lot of infighting, a lot of not getting along with each other, which is, I think, one reason why Michael Matt was doing the Unite the Clans rally cry. Do you think there's something particular to traditional Catholicism that leads to that? Do you think it's the modern situation? Do you think it's not true? That's not, we're not anymore, we don't infight any more than anybody else? How would you define, how would you explain that?
Well, many trads have what my colleague Kennedy Hall calls Vatican II PTSD. And what that means is, it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek way of saying they have been treated by their spiritual fathers with a certain amount of abuse. We're like abused children. And many Catholics are like this. But I think, I mean, trads have just been trying to have the mass of our forefathers, which, as Benedict XVI said, was never abrogated. We've been trying to do that for how many decades now? And we've been just vilified. It's very much the spirit in the statement of those faithful attached to the traditional Latin Mass, which talked about when you ask what father will give his son a stone instead of bread. And I think trads are just wounded, very much wounded, emotionally, spiritually. And it leads to bitterness. It leads to resentment. And this is not necessarily, it's obviously not a good thing, but this is what happens when you get wounded by your spiritual fathers. And so we get bitter, we get wounded. And so it's easy to cling then to a particular viewpoint, a particular explanation, a particular apparition, prophecy, or this or whatever, to try to latch onto something to get us through this crisis that is pushing us to the point of despair. And so, I don't know if I could say trads are more bitter or more uncharitable to one another. I think that's true in some areas, particularly the Twitter theologian mob. The Twitter theologian mob certainly is unfortunate, and we get into all these fights. So, I think that there's a lot of wounds, and we just get bitter with each other. So I think that we're trying to elevate that so that we can be real and be honest about the situation and try to spiritually heal with the riches of the traditional faith, which is the only way to heal spiritually, emotionally, and get us through this, pass down the faith to our children.
Okay. Now, when it comes to conservative and traditional Catholics being united, working together, let's first, what would you say is essentially the core things that unite conservative and traditional Catholics together?
Well, I would start with the oath of fidelity of John Paul II, which is in the 1990s, which was a similar thing to the oath against modernism. But different, but it was essentially, I accept the deposit of faith. The deposit of faith is the tradition. It is the scripture. It's the dogmas. The most important thing is the faith, the Orthodox Catholic faith. So when we talk about dogmas, we're not like Hans Kuhn. We don't question the resurrection of Christ. We don't question the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. We're not pushing for female ordination. It's already been settled. It was already settled as a universal tradition. We're not trying to ordain females to the priesthood. I think the core is the dogma, the dogmas of the faith, which, I mean, you can just read the catechism, the various catechism, Catechism of the Council of Trent, Catechism of Pius X, throw in the Baltimore Catechism, and most of the stuff that aligns with all that in the new catechism, we're all in agreement. We all accept all those things, all those dogmas, all those doctrines, according to their theological note, their certainty and binding force. We all agree on those things. So I would say that's the core, first of all, but I would add a corollary to that, which is closely tied to that, because lex orandi, lex credendi, the conservatives would also assert with the trads that the Latin Mass should be allowed. And this is, I mean, we can just call, I mean, I would consider the greatest active conservative, the greatest living conservative is Benedict. The greatest active conservative is Robert Cardinal Serra. And he says that, the church's only legitimacy is her consistency in her continuity. Liturgically, the church must be able to organize their peaceful cohabitation. So he made this statement after Traditiones Custodes, which was essentially restating what Ratzinger had already said, and that the Latin Mass must be allowed to continue, because that this is essentially the hermeneutic of continuity. So we would both agree. We would start to disagree when we talk about the new Mass and everything, but I would say conservatives and traditionalists would both agree that Traditionis Custodes is at the very least imprudent and should be reversed, if not ultra vires. out of his authority. But I mean, conservatives, I mean, EWTN, Raymond Arroyo condemned Tradiciones Custodes with the papal policy. George Weigel condemned it. So, I mean, I would say that the Latin Mass is another thing, because if we're going to accept all the dogmas of Trent, Ratzinger himself said that the reason they, meaning the heretics, hate the Latin Mass because they hate the dogmas of Trent. They hate the dogmas of Trent, and they hate the Trent Tridentine Mass. So those two things come together. If you accept the Council of Trent, you accept the Tridentine Mass. So I would put those two things as sort of these core things that actually unite them against the current regime in the Vatican.
Yeah, that's good. I think, as you're talking, one thing I thought of is that I think one fund, this kind of gets to our differences, but it's starts with what unites us, in that both conservative and traditional Catholics, I think, would argue that the faith cannot change. But I think that a conservative Catholic is much more open to it developing than a traditional Catholic. And those are loaded words, both change when it comes to doctrine and development. And there might be some traditional Catholics who reject the idea of development doctrine, but I think most accept it on principle that, yes, there is a development in understanding at the very least of doctrine. Like, for example, the Holy Trinity, there's clearly a development in understanding of the Holy Trinity from the first century to the fourth century. But there wasn't a change, obviously. And I think, like, where the rubber meets the road is on things like the death penalty, the teaching on the death penalty, that traditional Catholics, I think, on a whole, 100% were like, no, Pope Francis saying things like it's inadmissible and stuff, that's just wrong, because obviously the church has always taught that the death penalty can be acceptable in certain circumstances. Whereas conservative Catholics either were willing to, I saw some that actually would say, yeah, okay, it's inadmissible now. It's basically, it's no longer allowed. Like, the Pope has the authority to do that. Whereas others tried to kind of dance around the issue and say, well, inadmissible doesn't mean it's immoral. It's a different meaning. It's kind of like the Pope splaining a little bit. And I feel like that's a key division between traditional and conservative Catholics. It's like when these quote unquote developments happen, and they're called developments by people like the Pope and some others, traditionalists are like, no, that's a change. Whereas conservatives really try to find how it's trying to explain it as a development, or they just say, yeah, it's a development where what was X is now not X. Does that make sense? What do you think about that?
Like, yeah, I was trying to find this quote from Ripperger where he says something similar, where he says conservatives look at the prior magisterium in terms of the current magisterium, whereas the traditionalists view the current magisterium in terms of the prior magisterium.
Right. That's a very good.
We start there. And this is a paraphrase that I couldn't find the quote in time, right. But it's so we start with, it's a given that everything that's been passed down to us is the authority in the church, period. And this is something that you've brought out, Eric, is that we're not looking to the Pope for our faith. Our faith is in the tradition passed down to us. The Pope is there when we need him, when he needs to act according to his ministry, but the faith has already been passed down to us. We don't need to work on developing and work on doing all sorts of things to change the faith or develop the faith or adapt the faith, whatever. The faith is the faith. We've got it. What's the problem, I guess? There is this very strong effort to try to adapt things to the modern world. So a conservative might look at the current magisterium and sort of start there, start with the current Pope and what the current Pope is saying, start there and then look at the tradition. Now, to be fair, it is both and, obviously, because traditionalists don't reject the current magisterium or the current Pope, or, you know, the Pope still has authority. But there is a hierarchy of priority in our daily lives and in our doctrine. So I think that's a good way to say that. The death penalty is a good example because John Paul II was against the death penalty. To their credit, First Things actually published the appeal, I believe it was called Appeal to the Cardinals, which was signed by trads and conservatives, sort of against the death penalty, against the addition to the catechism. But it's a lot more debatable topic than things like the dogmas, of course.
Right. Yeah, I would say, like, you know, your liberal Catholics, they want things to change radically. The traditionalist doesn't want anything really to change, and the conservative is open to change, is probably more open to change than the traditionalist. Now, how does the traditional Catholic position differ then from Eastern Orthodoxy? Because Eastern Orthodoxy, you see a real, I mean, the I know they don't like when we say these things, but there's a real stagnation at times, which can be a good thing, by the way, when it comes to the faith. You know, it's not always a bad thing. But, I mean, they haven't had a council in over a millennium, and they don't, and they tend to move, they tend to reject the idea of development of doctrine itself. So how would you say a traditional Catholic view of this is different from the Eastern Orthodox? I know this is a little bit of field, but I think sure. It touches the point.
Yeah, well, the Eastern Orthodox, yeah, like as you pointed out, they don't have a current magisterium. It doesn't exist for them and hasn't existed for over 1,000 years. And so they are incapable of resolving anything. And so they just have problems between, like in Russia, you'll get rebaptized, or in Greece, you may not if you're a Catholic or something. So you've got differences of baptismal sacramental theology, which is huge. Yeah. If you're baptized, you're in the church. If you're not baptized, so we're talking about church membership, whether or not you're in the church. They disagree with each other about whether or not an individual person is in the church or not. But these are just going to be lasting problems, which they'll just continue to have, and they just sort of let them exist. And they disagree about contraception. Is it okay? Is it not? They disagree about the Immaculate Conception. They disagree about all these different things, and they can't resolve them. They're incapable of it because they don't have a magisterium. And so they have to be just content with just letting things be problematic and continue. Whereas the traditionalist would say, we are fighting for tradition to resolve this thing, and we believe that it can be resolved. We're actually trying to resolve it. We're trying to ask the Pope to decree anathema against XYZ prominent heresies today, which can actually happen and can actually do something. Essentially, we're trying to work with the magisterium to work this out. And that would be the difference, because we have the power through Christ's authority. Christ gave the church the authority to work out these problems and to definitively resolve them.
Right. Now, okay, so I really feel like that's probably a big difference there between the conservatives and the traditionalists, is the openness to change. And I use the word change, not development, on purpose. But like, because you see that the two things you already brought up, I think, are the big dividing lines, is the new mass and Vatican II. Now, the common criticism of conservatives towards traditional Catholics when it comes to Vatican II is that the traditionalist criticism of Vatican II goes so far as to call into question, practically, if not explicitly, you know, implicitly, I should say, rather than explicitly, maybe, the validity of the council, the idea that the Holy Spirit was active at the council. I mean, and so I think a lot of conservative Catholics would say that even your average mainstream traditional Catholic who claims that the council is valid, ultimately is almost in practice the same as the traditional Catholic on the fringe who says the council isn't valid. So how do you balance that and answer that criticism of the conservative Catholic that by criticizing the council as much as traditional Catholics do, we're calling into question its validity? And of course, as soon as you call into question its validity, you're calling into question a whole host of issues.
Sure. Well, I mean, the main thing is that we're calling on the current magisterium because we accept that the current magisterium has authority, and we want this current magisterium to resolve the magisterial situation. I would bring up past ecumenical councils that have been problematic. So, for example, the Council of Ephesus was in 431. And that council was so problematic that they had to have another council 20 years later. It wasn't even a generation had gone by before they had to have a totally new council.
They had to have a fake one in the middle just to also.
Yeah, they also. So, so it's not saying that not every council has authority, and we should, you know, trads. I think it's a fair criticism when trads sort of get too rebellious, if you will. They're sort of too unwilling to follow any authority whatsoever. Sort of that can, I think that's a fair criticism. But we need to work through these things with the current magisterium to work out what's going on. And it's not calling into question the church to say that this council had imperfections. I mean, trads accept 95% of Vatican II. That really, I mean, 95% of everything that's said in Vatican II is accepted by trads. This is the irony of Traditionis Custodes, is that your average trad parish confesses 95% of Vatican II's doctrine, as opposed to your average Novus Ordo, which we know by data that, you know, only 50% of Vatican II is accepted. There's just simply these different phrases, different aspects of Vatican II, which are not entirely clear. Now, once again, it's not calling into question a council or the church to say that's not clear. So, for example, we could get into this if you like, but for example, the Council of Trent left unresolved the question of the temporal power of Catholic kings and princes, which was a critical subject to resolve, because after that you have the absolutist monarchs, which leads to the French Revolution and all this nonsense and all our modern crisis today. So if I say, hey, the Council of Trent left this unsaid, and that was a serious, I wish they would have resolved that, I'm not calling into question the whole church. I'm just saying that there, God works in providence. He works through various things. Many different councils are an example of God bringing good out of evil. There's a lot of evil that happens at these councils. I perhaps think that the good out of evil that's going to happen in our current day is the repudiation of the false spirit of Vatican I, even as well as II, which is really its basis, which is sort of worshiping the Pope as this oracle where everything revolves around him. I think that's going to be a good that comes out of this evil. So I think that, to be fair, yes, I think there's a certain aspect of that where trads can go too far sometimes, but we're not saying that the council is totally invalid or the church is invalid. If there's aspects of it which were deficient or need to be added or clarified, various things like that, because it's happened at other councils, it's okay. We can resolve these things. That God is big enough to resolve these things.
Right. Yeah, you brought up a big issue. I wouldn't mind. We probably have another podcast about that, the false spirit of Vatican I. I think a lot of Catholics, conservative and traditional, have kind of recognized that this, like you said, looking at the Pope as this oracle in which the whole faith revolves around has caused a lot of problems. I think a lot of conservative Catholics in the era of JP II, particularly, and even Benedict some, and I'm putting myself in this category, we fell into that error that when we debated with the liberal Catholics, we just say, well, JP II said this, like that was the argument. And that was now the argument was over because we had the trump card of JP2. Well, now they're using Francis against us mm-hmm. meaning both conservative and traditional Catholics. And so it's like, if it was valid then, it's got to be valid now. And I would say it wasn't valid then. We shouldn't have been doing that. And so therefore, it's not valid now. Now, okay, we talked about Vatican II a little bit. Obviously, by the way, everybody's listening, this could be a 10-hour conversation. I get it. We're trying to cover kind of the main aspects for a relatively short podcast. So Vatican II, I think it clearly divides us between conservative and traditional Catholics, because conservatives would say you really can't criticize the documents as much as the spirit that came out of it. the false implementation, whereas traditionally, you know, I think we need to look at the documents themselves, the council itself, and see that some of the cracks formed there and later became much bigger, but they were first formed there. Now the mass, I feel like this is like probably the most sensitive one, because I know a number of Catholics, you even say the phrase Novus Ordo and they get upset. And I think some of that is because of the fact that traditionally some traditional Catholics use that phrase as a term of derision, contempt. I mean, almost it was like saying like a Novus Ordo. I mean, it just, you couldn't say it, but of course, technically that's what it is. Novus Ordo Missae. That's the name of it. The new order of mass. And so when we look at the new mass, I think it's fair to say traditional Catholics on a whole would prefer just to jettison it and go back to the traditional Latin mass. I mean, it's kind of what makes them traditional Catholics. Whereas obviously conservative Catholics are like, no, let's throw out the baby with bathwater. We think it's okay. What would you say to conservative Catholics kind of to say, to get them to rethink and relook at the deficiencies, the potential deficiencies in the new mass itself?
Sure. I mean, first of all, we should just say, you know, this criticism is not against any particular person who attends the new mass, anything like that. I mean, I would just, St. Paul says, if my brother falls, I'm not going to eat meat forever. So you don't want me to say Novus Ordo, that's fine. I'll say new mass of Paul VI, whatever. So no dispersions against any particular faithful Catholic who is growing in holiness and overcoming sin at the new mass and has experienced the real presence of Christ at the new mass. All those things are true. All those things are valid. We don't want to criticize any particular soul or particular person. But if we look in more detail at some of the things that were done in the texts and rubrics of the new mass, so we're separating the actual mass from its abuses, because we all condemn those. We all agree on those. When we look at those things, we see that there are some troubling aspects to that. And I would tell my conservative Catholic friends that these are some of the things that Ratzinger himself had a problem with. And so I would recommend to you various texts of Ratzinger or the texts that he recommended, like Klaus Gamber's Reform of the Roman Liturgy, for example. Ratzinger said that we abandoned the organic development of the liturgy and substituted in its place a banal fabrication in terms of a technical manufacturing. Because here's the key point, is that in the whole missal, the old mass from 1962, the whole missal, it's like 1,000 pages long, 83% of that whole missal was taken out and reinvented in the new mass. And so they literally took out pages of the old mass, 83% of it, and they put all their new prayers into this new mass. And unfortunately, they targeted particular things that were offensive to modern man or offensive to Protestants. So they took out things like the word sin, the word mortification, the word sacrifice, the word wrath. They took these things out in the actual Latin text of the new mass. And then after they had done that, then they put out the translation, which removed more words that were offensive to modern man. Now, when I say offensive to modern man, that's the actual words that they say. So in 1969, there was a document called Comme le Prévoit, which was the principles of liturgical translation. And it said some of these things are against modern Christian teaching, like the word handmaid, the word merit, the word enemies of Holy Church. Let's take those out. They're in the Latin new mass, but we're going to take them out when we translate them into English. And that's why English speakers know that there was a retranslation. There's a third edition. That's instead of Lord be with you and also with you, now it's Lord be with you and with your spirit. Because one of the things they wanted was to take away the word spirit. So this is an example, but the problem is they already did that to the Latin. So the original promulgated new mass in the Latin also takes out these words. So there's already been a reversal of Cum Le Pauvoir with Liturgium Authenticum in 2001. So that's how we got the third Roman Missal in the new Mass that you, that conservative Catholics are familiar with, and with your spirit. But the problem was they didn't go further and go back to the original Latin in 1962, which is the so-called Latin Mass, which contains all the rest of the words that they took out. Now, Pope Francis reversed this reversal. So there was Cum Le Pauvoir, that got reversed, and then Pope Francis reversed that reversal. So we got a reversal of the reversal. And then again, Traditionis Custodes again reversed that reversal. going all these crazy reversals of the reversals. But basically the conservatives, I mean, do you want to, if you're giving your children the Bible to read? Now, obviously we're going to give it, if I'm teaching my 8-year-old about David and Bathsheba, I'm going to leave out a few details, but eventually we're going to tell the whole story to my kids. And that's the thing about the Mass is, like, do you want to tell the whole story, the whole Catholic faith that's contained in the prayers of our forefathers? Do you want to teach our children to pray about averting the wrath of God, pray about the mortification of our sins, the bonification of our flesh, the penance for our sin, those types of things that got thrown out? Well, yeah, of course you do. And so that's why we are saying the Latin Mass, we need to rethink this liturgical reform, because unfortunately Paul VI let somebody loose on the liturgy, which by all appearances did not have goodwill for the faith. So that's the situation.
So the conservative argument that what we really need is just a reverently celebrated new Mass, that the problem is abuse, is that, you know, if we just had a reverently celebrated new Mass, there wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't need the traditional Latin Mass. That's essentially what you're saying, is it's so different. It's left out so much that that's just not sufficient. That's not really the sufficient way over. Would you agree with that assessment? Like, it really needs to be to return to traditional Latin Mass.
Yes. And now I would point again people to Klaus Gamber's book, because he basically lays it all out. Now, we do want to point out that Lefebvre was in favor of reforming some aspects of the Latin Mass. And so I don't think it's necessarily the case that trads need to say, well, the Latin Mass needs to be 1962 and never change for the end of time. I think that's too extreme, because there needs to be certain aspects and adjustments. But this was the debate in the 1960s among the bishops and the cardinals, because many of them were against this new Mass. The new Mass actually was given to the bishops in 1967, and they didn't approve it. They did a trial run of the new Mass at the Synod of Bishops, and they did not give their approval. So there was a big debate. But no, the Reverent Novus Ordo will not contain an offertory prayer which beseeches God to accept this sacrifice for my sins. It'll have, blessed are you, Lord, God of the universe, etc., etc. Because that's just been taken out of the Latin. You can do a Novus Ordo in Latin. It's not going to contain these references to sacrifice. It's not going to contain these references to wrath, sin, all these things. It's not going to contain 83% of the prayers from the old Mass. So, no, it's not sufficient to simply have a Latin Reverent Novus Ordo.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, I found a lot of people, even to this day, believe the new Mass is essentially the old Mass in English, in the vernacular. They don't understand it's actually got a lot of differences. I just want to ask real quick, where do you get the 83% figure?
That is based on two scholars. It is 83%. Let me see. I don't think I'm going to find it. Oh, I've got it. Here we go. I had my bookmark on it. Okay. So this is based on Cicada's book, Work of Human Hands. And you can also see, I think it's Matthew Hazel, a new liturgical movement. He's confirming these things as well. So there's a, you can put it in the show notes or something for this new liturgical movement, but he basically counts up all of the, there's, let's see. there's 425. Okay. Let me just give you the numbers. I'll give you all the numbers. So the traditional mass contains 1,182 orations. So those are particular prayers which are unique to that particular day. So today we have the Seven Sorrows of Our Lady, or the Our Lady of Sorrows. I don't know when you're going to post this, but today is September 15th. So there's particular prayers for this day. So there is the introit, the collect, the right. All these things. Those are orations. So there's 1,182 of these. Of these, 760 were just dropped entirely. So they were thrown out altogether. And then of the approximately 36 which remain, they then altered another half of those. So then you're left with only 200 total that were left untouched from the old mass to the new mass.
Okay.
So that's where the breakdown in terms of the numbers.
Okay. Okay. I just wanted to, I knew people might say like, wait, where's he getting this 83% from? Okay. One last thing I want to talk about is that one thing I think is clear is that the traditional Catholic movement has grown considerably in the last few years. And I would argue, and this is anecdotal evidence, but I would argue it, most of its growth have come from conservative Catholics kind of transitioning to be more traditional. I mean, you see a well-known figure such as like Taylor Marshall, who was obviously was a conservative Catholic, and now he considers himself a traditional Catholic. I would bring myself into that category as well. And so we see Latin Mass numbers are rising considerably. In fact, a lot of people think that's, of course, the big reason why Francis released his motu proprio is because of the fact that if it was just a few French people involved in the traditional Latin Mass, it wouldn't have mattered. Another person, I'm just thinking of off the top of my head, like Janet Smith is another major figure who was a mainstay of the conservative Catholic movement. And now, you know, she's a traditional Catholic. Why do you think it is that so many conservative Catholics have kind of moved over to traditional Catholicism? And do you think that, so it's a two-part question, why do you think that's happening? And secondly, do you think that bodes ill for trying to unite the remaining conservative Catholics with traditional Catholics, because a lot of people don't like it when, you know, a lot of people are moving over to another camp, so to speak.
Well, I think why are they I think the number one reason is experiencing the presence of Jesus Christ in the Latin Mass. I think that's the number one reason, is that people experience God. They experience the real presence of Christ. This is what ultimately unites all of us, is that we love Jesus Christ and we seek to honor him, obey him, worship him. And you, when you experience the Latin Mass, you experience the glory of the Tridentine Rite. This is something that can change you. So I think that's the biggest thing, is that I think that goes to your former question, is that that reverent Novus Ordo, it just simply, here's another example. There's not as many genuflections. When the consecration happens in the Latin Mass, Jesus Christ is suddenly present. What does the priest immediately do in the Latin Mass? He genuflects. The king has arrived, he genuflects. In the Novus Ordo, that doesn't happen. Reverend Novus Ordo, he elevates first.
They don't do genuflection right after the consecration?
Yes, he elevates first. Some priests will actually add the genuflection, but the rubrics in the Novus Ordo do not say.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're saying in the traditional Latin Mass, it's kneeling elevation?
Yeah, correct. So the consecration happens in the Novus Ordo, and then immediately he elevates the host.
Right.
So he does not actually worship God first. So just ask yourself, if Jesus Christ walked in the room right now, what would you do? You'd fall on your knees.
Yeah.
You're not going to do anything else than that. And so that this is just a great example of the traditional Latin Mass adds this genuflection. And it's just simply something that is natural and really all these different aspects to it. There's all these other genuflections, there's other things, obviously.
So I'm just going to real quick show my ignorance. I've been going to church Latin mass for 10 years now, but I always have my head down and my eyes closed during the consecration. So I actually don't know this. So what you're saying, and I think there might be others who don't know this. So in the Novus Ordo, the new mass, you have consecration, elevation, genuflection.
Correct.
In the traditional Latin mass, you have consecration, genuflection, elevation, genuflection. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, honestly, I didn't even know that. I think I've never noticed the genuflection before the elevation in the traditional Latin mass, because like I said, my practice is always has my head down and my eyes closed usually during that, which that's not like something I have to do. It just happens to be what I do.
You're bowing your head. You're doing what's natural. But I maybe a more conspicuous example is the prayers at the foot of the altar. So before the priest ascends the altar, he bows and he confesses his sins. This is a great example, I think, because in the prayers at the foot of the altar, we repent of our sins before we can ascend the altar. In the Novus Ordo, you just go right up to the altar and you kiss the altar.
Right.
So that's just, so these are the types of things that are just moving people's souls, moving people's hearts who love the Lord. And so I think that's why people are becoming traditional in terms of just going, conservative Catholics just going to the Latin mass now. They just experience the Lord Jesus Christ and they want more of him. They want to worship and adore him. And so this is just the movement of pious souls. What was your second question? It was,
do you think that's going to cause tension and problems in trying to unite us together in the work of the church? Like the fact that, you know, a lot of conservative Catholics might be feeling a bit defensive right now because a lot of their friends, a lot of people they looked up to as kind of conservative Catholic leaders are now moving over to a more traditional Catholicism.
Yeah. Right.
You think that's going to be a problem then working, you know, kind of crossing the aisle, so to speak? I don't want to make it sound like it's political parties because we're definitely way more united than, you know, in that. But, you know, do you think that's going to cause problems?
Yeah. I mean, every time things like this happen, it does cause problems when, you know, one spouse has an experience of Christ in the Latin mass, the other spouse doesn't like it or doesn't appeal to them. That's a tension that needs to be resolved, obviously. And it's going to happen in families and communities. And so that always brings the tension. But if we have the humility to have the this attitude where we just want more of Christ, no matter what. I don't care what it is. I just want more of knowing, loving, serving Jesus Christ now and in eternity. So if we have this attitude of wanting to grow in holiness, we will be open to what our friends or brothers find is, it's similar to Eric, you saying to me, hey, I just read this great text, this great spiritual work. Take a look at this. This is awesome. It changed my life. You know, if I love the Lord, I'll say, wow, great. Thanks for the recommendation. I'll take a look at it. You know, this is something that, you know, I don't need to say, well, you're in this party, I'm in this party. We're both in the same party of the Lord. Right. We're both on the same team, ultimately, trying to get to heaven, trying to save our souls and the souls of our children. So there's this sort of healthy competition in the sense of I want to learn the best way to grow in holiness. And if somebody can help me with that, that's awesome.
Right. Okay. I think we're running about out of time here. I want to keep it to about an hour or so. A couple things. First of all, before we go, I want to encourage everybody, obviously, check out 1 Peter 5. I'm going to put some links in the show notes. The editorial stance is a good one. I just kind of see what it's doing. Like I said, it's our sister publication, and I think we are working together for the good of the church. What's like maybe a final thing you want to say, Tim, to both conservative and traditional Catholics about how we can work together?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can both... We both are Orthodox. We both agree on the doctrines, and we need to see the imminent enemy bearing down on us, which is the liberal heretics who are trying to push the church in the direction of heresy to destroy souls. And so if you care about the mystical body of Christ, we need to work together in whatever way we can to fight against this. That once again, Cardinal Sarah, just read his text, Credibility of the Church. And he basically lays it out sort of a way for us to unite against the abrogation of the Latin Mass. Whether you, I mean, many conservatives, whether they like the Latin Mass, they attend the Latin Mass or not, they agree that the Latin Mass should not be abrogated because it calls into question, as Sarah says, the credibility of the church, the very legitimacy of the church. Right. As Benedict said, what was sacred for us to prior generations is sacred today, and it cannot be forbidden and or called harmful. And so this is really our unity, is that we do desire the same glory, the greater glory for God, and we desire this tradition and this Orthodox faith, and we disagree on more difficult and complex matters, but we can agree on more clear matters like the faith and the Latin Mass.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, I think we're going to cut it out there. I while we've been talking, I thought about 400 different things we could talk about, but we'll stick to that because I don't like listening to a podcast longer than an hour, so I'm not going to make other people do that either. All right. Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, Tim. Like I said, check out 1 Peter 5. Until next time, then, everybody, God love you.